The founders forgot that we had medical liberty.
We seem to be losing by taking the side of the middle. And we seem to constantly be losing.
I think Trump has made some kind of arrangements with Russia.
This person has made the allegations that they were a man.
If there's content that's borderline, that's content that we basically will not.
There is no second best. There's no second best crypto asset.
Let's talk about science.
I respect you and I have a great deal of appreciation to you, JF, because in a time when everybody was attacking me, when Sargon doxed me and smeared me, you were the only one who gave me a platform, and you were very kind in helping me put the truth out there.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Jeff G Tonight. Chill show tonight. I don't have much to say, but I've been taking 2 days without the shows because yesterday I was on Richard Spencer and Jan Rushdie. So that was already 2 shows in the day. I didn't have the energy to do a regular show on top of it. So I thought, let's come and do a show because I don't like being off the internet for 3 days in a row. End of the line. I really like the Patreon and Subscribestar ID that we've developed, which is to have this private chat room with the Patreons, because the regular private show people have difficulty attending it because it was at a specific time of the month and not everyone could do it because of work and stuff. So it's good to have this Discord chat room. It's hashtag general-patrons. And it's only accessible for those at the $20 level in the Patreon and the Subscribestar. An ID from Nick Fuentes that I've borrowed. Very good ID. People can ask their questions to me. And where if you came to me with a very personal question outside of this room, I would probably just deny it or just ignore it because it's too personal. But on the Patreon, it's easier to talk more in depth about private stuff or deep beliefs that I have, because I know that it's along the friends of the show. End of the line, Joel says, JF, recently Millionaire Woes said that earning money now as a dissident right commentator / writer is unsustainable. I sympathize, especially since many normal careers are closed off to canceled people. For the lucky few online right people who are not banned for money platforms like Patreon, some still have to do non-activist, normal contracts to survive. For every frontest type who can earn huge amounts every year, despite most payment processor cancellations, there are 99 right-wing commentators who are barely getting by. No one is coming to save you is a phrase that is true. What strategy should a cancelled right-wing commentator take in order to earn some reasonable income while still commentating? I mean, that is the key to my life, and you really have to be prepared, because I knew what I was signing up for when I started this career. So the tricks that you've seen me deploy are the tricks. I would say there are four different tricks. The first is to have parallel platforms that don't allow cancellation. So have networks of donors that are Bitcoin-wise, have an audience that is more tech-oriented, so they know about payment options. So to have already, to cultivate an audience of non-normies is already a kind of protection against cancellation, because there will always be one little company that allows something, or the blockchain will allow it. But you know, you need people who are motivated enough to fund your activities. So the first rule is cultivate a tech-savvy audience and parallel platforms and parallel routes, and don't be desperate because of cancellation. Just go to the next. Just favor the competition until, you know, something like Rumble used to be a kind of out there platform for really secondary quality stuff. it is becoming more and more the platform for video free speech. X isn't quite there. X is there for text, but it's not there for video totally yet. So Rumble is really an example of how dissidents can go to a platform and make it attractive, and it works. So that is the first tip. The second tip is be independent of wealth through crypto investment. So if you can stabilize your life with crypto investment, the crypto cycle is very simple. It's years of bull run, then 2 years of bear market, then years of bull run, let's say two, or sometimes it will extend maybe to 3 years of bull run. And then follow the market and make sure that whatever the little amounts that you have, that you fructify them to the maximum using Bitcoin. So never rely on, well, ideally you don't rely on the month's income to survive, because if you don't have a buffer in terms of crypto, or if you chew your crypto too quick because you need it to pay whatever, you're not going to make it. Thirdly, have passive income stuff like the revolutionary phenotype. You need to find a way where even if your work fails or you're tired or your show isn't as popular for X reason, you need to have passive income opportunities where you're going to keep selling that book and it's going to keep bringing some money. Even if it's a small amount of money per month, it's very significant when you consider that you don't have to work for it, and that in the bad times it might be your floor, but it's a good enough floor to lay on. Passive income is my third tip for ideological resistance. And that's pretty much it. Did I have a fourth tip in mind? I don't know. Investment, passive income. Oh yeah, and the fourth tip is try to develop business in weird internet sectors where you are needed and where they don't care that you're canceled. So perhaps work anonymously as a self-employed person, or work under a pseudonym, or you can work as a programmer, translator, things that are needed online where they really just care that you deliver the product and they don't care who you are. And sometimes you can even work under the company name or a pseudonym because you get paid contract money and it gets paid to your company and they never really get to know who they hired. So those are the four tips. Yes, I did read the Medieval Woes text. It was really tearing me apart. Medieval Woes, support needed. This is a personal post and a request for help. I hate asking, but it is now crucially necessary. I need somewhere to do Medieval this year. I mean a physical location from which I can live stream the festival. If you have a spare room with electricity and internet, please get in touch. Otherwise, I simply don't see how I can do it. I need to drastically increase my income so that this doesn't happen again. The problem isn't the rent. I can afford that. The problem is that the landlords now expect you to earn 3x that rent, and my monthly donations don't add up to anything like that much. They use agencies to check this, so I'm having real difficulty securing a new home, even in rural Scotland. Hence, problem number one. So sad to hear that Medieval Woes is in trouble like this, because let me tell you, if you don't make it through your peak and buy a house, if you don't find a way to use your career's peak to buy a house that will secure you for the rest of your life, you're gonna experience very bad moments, just like Lawrence Sutton, you know, ending up in a trailer park. If you didn't use your peak to buy a stable house that will be your residence where you won't have to pay rent, you're going to keep getting drained until the system cancels you hard enough that you're not making enough money to pay the rent, and now you get pressed out like a lemon. So absolutely, one of the main things that a dissident has to do is, if you're headed toward cancellation, you need to make a lot of money in your first year of peak, and you need to use all that money for investment purpose in a way that will allow you to buy a house cash, no loan, no mortgage. They're not going to help you. They're going to see your name at the bank. They're going to say no. So have what it takes to have a buffer so much that you have your entire house paid for. I don't see how people survive with rent stuff. I don't get it, honestly. I couldn't live with the stress on the... I've been in rents. I've been, as a young adult, I've been renting these apartments to do these jobs here and there, go to Duke University. But it's... How can you live not knowing next year where you will be, not knowing if your landlord is going to kick you out, not knowing if there's enough place for future children or what you're going to do with your children. Having children and the rent, I cannot have both. So I wouldn't be able to live under this anxiety of constantly being on the run, constantly having to interview. Also, this process of applying for an apartment is ridiculously painful. It's ridiculously normie filtering. It's ridiculously female coded, the way they want your social security number, and they know everything about you, and anything wrong they will pick someone else. There's just too much demand, not enough offer on this market, and so they basically can make you dance like Marty McFly in the Wild Wild West. Darko Malfoy says, je pense que c'est très important pour la personne blanche pour parler le saoulement de l'anglais. Well, you don't speak very good French. I would keep it to English for you. End of the line. Joel says, Millionaire Woes is apparently good at 3D stuff like Blender. You should try contracting with that. Absolutely. If you produce 300 little cutie birds in 3D, different shapes, different feathers, different colors, you sell it as the ultimate Angry Bird pack. Don't call them Angry Bird. Let's say the ultimate gaming bird pack. You put this on Sketchfab and you sell this for $300 a license. So if you buy the 300 little birds, you can include the 300 little birds in any game you create as a programmer. There is a business for this, and I think that it's possible that it could be a way for him to survive. Duck U says, Sweden has affordable homes for less than 50k. Yeah, you have to go for these low price homes if you want to get out of the vicious cycle of rent. We have a couple of super chats that I wanted to address. Darko Malfoy has sent super chats to Entropy. Thank you so much. He says, Jeff, I've never liked science much. I feel it simply describes how things happen and not why. For instance, photosynthesis, the nature of consciousness, why species are 50-50 male-female, etc. I have always been more of an arts and humanities guy. And I feel we get a bad rep. In our defense, at least, we are trying to explain the why. And by the way, most sciences are woke as any arts department nowadays. Well, it is true that the Academia of Science has become increasingly woke and just annoyingly bureaucratic. That being said, let's not forget that the Academia is not science. So I will address your attack as science, not as a defender of Academia. First, I don't think that arts and humanity are after the why. Arts and humanities are, you can engage with art in a way that is questioning some aspect of why of something in nature or why of something in life or in morality. But you can also do art, and most art, in fact, is insignificant and doesn't carry this why quest. And so I would say it's not a fair evaluation to see the arts and humanities as questioning the why or trying to explain the why. It's merely a subsection of arts and humanity. And I would say, to your point about science, the same is true of science. There is a lot of how of mechanistic science out there, just let's see how this molecule works and let's describe it. But there is a lot of, there is good why research, and evolutionary theory is one example of a purely why field. Evolutionary theorists like Richard Dawkins, Robert Trivers, me, we have never cared about, we haven't engaged in like describing a molecule, or I don't care about DNA because of the molecule or the chemistry of it. I've never engaged on the chemistry of DNA. I am in the why of DNA and why it is at the top of a three-layer genetic code, and those are all why questions. Now, I would argue also that we don't have a super strong definition of the distinction between the why and the how. The why is more like a feeling of depth. When you see a scientific theory, the scientific theory will be descriptive of something. It will be descriptive of either what you see, or it will be descriptive of a mechanism behind what you see. And the more deep we go in the behind, the more we have the impression that we're in the why. But the reality is that all theories are fictitious mechanisms that you can hold in your brain. They are either true or false on the basis of empiricism, which is on the basis of the how, of the observation, of just the raw facts of nature coming to your senses. So let's not forget that this depth of the big why question is kind of a philosophical delusion. Ultimately, if you have every piece of information to explain in the most concise way everything that you see, you don't need anything deeper than this. The deeper than this would be a delusion. Going one step more and saying, oh, I want to explain all of it through God or all of it through some fiction that I make for myself, that would be the extra step in the pursuit of the why, where you delude yourself into an impression that you have understood better than most people when you didn't. Darko Malfoy says, are Jews physiopsychologically evil, paranoid, overly ethnocentric at this point after this much inbreeding? Well, first, I wouldn't say inbreeding, because you don't know. You don't know why the Jews would have acquired some feature. It doesn't have to be because of inbreeding. It could be because of natural selection. So when a group acquires a feature, to take for granted that it's because of inbreeding is wrong. Now, have they developed a paranoid approach with the world, a self-centered approach? I would argue perhaps when you are for a thousand year, if you spend a thousand year where your people are in between countries trading, you probably need a cognition that is very fleeting. A cognition that exploits the most of each transaction to your advantage and benefit. If you survive that way, probably, yes. Probably you could have been naturally selected to be more greedy or more paranoid, more fearful of the other, and to have layers of defense that perhaps the sedentary person doesn't need. Rodilacid says, I'm sure that Ben Shapiro is 99% Ashkenazi purely by random chance. Yeah, that is one of the fascinating things about Jews, is this unwillingness to engage publicly about racial choice in dating, which is fundamentally observable across all societies. It is like a very, of all the social knowledge we have, the idea that people date within their own race in a mixed society is one of the most solid cross-societal observations in the social sciences. It is true everywhere you go. There is a discount on the value of the mate when they are from another race. And the Jews know this. That's why they're dating within the Jews. And it's like, I just wish they would be honest about it. Like, let's talk about it. It doesn't require much more than a 10-minute acknowledgement in a podcast. If you're going to do podcast all of your life, speak to the people. You speak to white people all of your life. You make a business out of it. Why don't you spend 10 minutes explaining that, yeah, you know, you date a person of your race because you want to continue your racial existence. You believe it's something valuable to be continued into the world. Darko Malfoy says, let's say JF is Jewish. Behavior from the Talmud and Torah or from... Is Jewish behavior from the Talmud or the Torah or from biological conditioning? Big question, of course. Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, there's not a border. I've always said that there's no distinction between nature and nurture. So if you follow the Talmud, well, you had genes that were telling you to follow the Talmud. They were telling you, maybe they were not telling you exactly to follow the Talmud. Maybe they were telling you to believe any book that your father gets to you. But that's the same thing. In the end, it ends up being a gene for following the Talmud. So even if it comes from a book, even if the behavior comes from a training process, it is a training process that has biological components to it. So it's really not worth it to try to distinguish between nature and nurture in that way. Man... I have discovered a new food. This week, I have accomplished two things that were on my to-do list for life. They were things that I really wanted to do before I die. The first thing is I have tasted the haggis, this Scots pudding preparation of meat, pieces from a sheep wrapped in a sheep's stomach. So those are the linings of a sheep's stomach. You can still smell the vomity aspect of the sheep's stomach. When you open the aluminium paper, it's still sweating that smell. Now they put the hearts, the lungs, and the kidneys and livers of the sheep into a blender, or they cut it in very small grounded style, and they mix it with suet, with basically grain, oatmeal, and it makes this kind of pate. When you eat it, the stomach is kind of expanding because the water vapor is pushing outwards, and so it expands and it becomes really, really tight. And now you can open it with a knife hit. I said, haggis, scary at first, but delicious smells. Delicious once in mouth. Smells of stomach vomit, kidney meat, but impressively floral once in mouth. There was maybe even an odor of kind of urine. Of kind of cow urine that I was detecting. It's absolutely disgusting when you look at it and when you open it from the aluminium paper and you smell all of this. But when you taste it, this is very, very good. This is very good meat mixture of extreme taste. I don't know that there's a way you can make meat more tasty than this. This is the tastiest of the meat mixture, which is why the Scots poet Burns was talking about Haggis and said that it was the chieftain of the pudding race. Wow. Absolutely good. Very, very good. Oniony, cereally, lots of cereal in there, lots of oatmeal. And then all of it is kind of binded by the meat glue formed by the kidney, heart, and lung. The most tasty piece of meat I have had in my life. I enjoy it more, I would say, just from a pure meat perspective, forgetting about the crust. This is better than a Quebecois meat pie. The mixture of meat is better than a Quebecois meat pie. And let me tell you, I'm a big fan of the Quebecois meat pie. This is good. The spicing of it is spectacular. The other thing I wanted to do before I die is understand the Riemann hypothesis and the zeta function. And I finally got to it with the help of Grok. I did yesterday. Well, I would say I over the last 3 days, I've come to understand the full problem, because I've always been intimidated by the fact that it works with complex numbers. And I never really got into working with complex numbers, and I had to get unshied. And I got unshied this week. Asking Grok some explanations about it to help me. Now I understand complex numbers. It's really not that hard. It's not hard at all. It's complex numbers. They just have two values, and one is real, one is imaginary, and they work in a certain way. You just have to know these ways. Now, once I've understood complex numbers, I was able to understand the Riemann hypothesis, and I had lots of fun because I started by telling Grok, hey, I'd like to develop an original way to prove the hypothesis. And Grok started talking to me about, well, there are people on the web who claim to have found a proof already. They've just not been reviewed by professionals. And so I discovered Noel, Mr. Noel, and I was like, I discovered his proof, and I was like, this looks interesting. Doesn't look like there's a primary massive error. Is it valid? And Grok was like, yeah, you know, maybe it's valid. Grok was giving me a little bit of critiques, but I was like, these critiques are quite superficial. I'm pretty sure that he's already addressed those. And today we got Grok to accept his proof. So is the Riemann hypothesis proven? Well, I don't know. We'll have to see what's the reaction of mathematicians. But since 2020, this guy has been having his own YouTube channel. But I was looking at his videos. He has like 700 videos. This is the kind of guy I would invite on my show back in the days, you know, like Bill Gates, to hear about his crazy hypotheses. Today Grok... was Mr. Noel, talked to Grok and explained to him that's the justification for this equation. That's my justification here. And Grok accepted it. It seems like the proof is not super evidently, fundamentally flawed. End of the line, Joel says, JF, your work on mathematical proofs, do you fear that AI will steal your work that you have already contributed to this? Well, I think it's possible, and you have to be careful. If you are a mathematician working on these things, you don't want to give it all to AI. You don't want to give it all to AI, because especially, I'm sure that there's AI detection that escalates. Like, if Grok ends up finding an important proof, I'm sure that he's going to tell the CEO, and the CEO, whoever is operating Grok, will tell Elon Musk. And I'm sure that we are not totally private when we speak to AI. Definitely, we are. When we look at the TOS, it's very clear they have the right to see your discussion with AI. So because of this, I would be very careful. Now, when I have a big advance or anything, what I like to do is publish a paper or publish a video about it so that it's on the public space. Even
You've
if
said
I publish...
in the past our current society isn't selecting for IQ. Do you think a technological society could do it in principle, or is it doomed to decay due to lack of selection pressure for the skills required to maintain it?
I'll answer this once I'm done. So even if you'd publish an imperfect note or a video that's kind of put together at the last minute, if you can only put on the public space that you've been working on some forms of the equation, you can already protect yourself from getting stolen by AI. But up to now, we have no case in history where an AI company or an AI CEO would have stolen literally an ID from someone. Although some people argue that the whole of AI is just a big stealing enterprise. Like, AI is trained on cultural products that are copyright. And that is a big question. Like, we are draining out human creativity and reproducing it artificially. And yet we're not paying the artists, the mathematicians, the scientists who have contributed to the equations that today form the brain of AI. So let's see what Jackie Chan had sent.
You've said in the past our current society isn't selecting for IQ. Do you think a technological society could do it in principle, or is it doomed to decay due to lack of selection pressure for the skills required to maintain it?
Well, I believe both things are true. In principle, you could. In principle, you absolutely can select for IQ. Imagine that you make an IQ test. If you're below a certain amount, you don't get to reproduce. We sterilize you. We chop your balls. We remove your ovaries, so definitely you could, in principle. Now, I don't think we'll do it, and I think in reality, what happens is inevitably that the game of intelligence is not a super favorable game because the advances that you produce can be easily copied, easily taken over, used by others that are less intelligent, and so there's a constant drain to the bottom. And especially when there's an increase in numbers. When there's an increase in numbers and being high IQ doesn't particularly lead you to want a very large family. In fact, it seems to be a punishment evolutionarily to have high IQ. The people with high IQ want to make less babies. Because of all these factors, I think we are practically, although not in principle, but practically always headed toward less intelligence. And it requires very, very rare and special circumstances for intelligence to be useful enough. And the more there are people, the more we mass produce the products of intelligence, you know. Maybe intelligence 500 years ago could get you out of a lot of troubles, a lot of situation, could help you produce much more food for your family. But we mass produce food, we mass produce impressions of security through the city, and we mass produce everything that you may need so that you are not dependent on the system. But at the same time, we are also punishing intelligence because intelligence now serves nothing. You can absolutely survive at 60 IQ in North America. Darko Malfoy says the answer is you cannot let females choose their mate. I mean, female choice is one of the last ramparts of you could think that if females are enacting preferences that they've acquired in the past, they will choose high IQ people still. And they kind of do. There's an intelligence test as part of the courtship of human beings. Human couples get together. Laughter, comedy, capacity to engage, empathy are all things that are measured by women during the courtship phase. But they probably, in a world where intelligence is punished, they probably don't have a huge interest at pursuing it through sexual selection either. So eventually sexual selection cannot save you from the reality of natural selection. If intelligence is bad, it doesn't matter that intelligence was good before, that intelligence may be charming psychologically for the woman. In the end, the woman will evolve toward not choosing intelligence if intelligence is so punitive. One other thing I did this week is I watched Happy Gilmore 2. Let me tell you, this is an interesting movie. It has only 6.1 IMDb rating. It's a good comedy movie that you can watch in 2025 that makes you feel like it's still the 90s. Because it's really... the movie doesn't have anything innovative. It's just a rematch of Happy Gilmore 1. Same themes, same characters. But out of all these revisiting movies, because they've done a couple of those, they've done Jurassic Park, where the last Jurassic Park that they've done is basically a walk around all of the past scenes of the first movie. Where, oh, we get to see the mathematics professor again. Yes, Jeff Goldblum. Oh, we get to see the pile of shit again. Oh, we get to see... And it's like they just repeat the scenes of the first movie. Happy Gilmore 2 is a movie like this. It is a just repeat of the same themes. But it's well done. Out of these crap movies that just revisit the number one, these remakes, it's well done. You get really the original feel of a 90s comedy with Adam Sandler. I believe that it's hilarious. The addition that they've done in this is, it's like a war between classic golf and new golf. And the new golf is a kind of super golf that is pushed by some deluded utopian transhumanist who wants to biologically modify the golfers so they become super golfers and they're able to drive 500 yards all the time. And it's a cheat kind of, and they want to make golf into a massive consumption product. They want to make golf into this ridiculous place where the greens can move, where one of the guys has a chainsaw, you know. They want to make it a spectacle like wrestling. And it's funny how Gen Z to Gen X, how young adults are represented in this movie. They are represented as this kind of generation that pursues absolute nihilism and that doesn't care about the tradition of golf. And Adam Sandler is presented as siding with the classic golfers and trying to restore order here. Instead of being the chaotic agent, he finds himself on the side of classic golfing. So yeah, it's not a super innovative movie. But it's funny enough, and it's current enough, and it is 90s enough to be enjoyable. Thank you very much for the super chat. Friend of Gandalf has sent a big super chat during the night, and he was telling me, Jeff, I have something to tell you about carrot toxicity. Hi, Jeff. On the toxicity of carrots, while vitamin A may play a role in the toxification of human tissue, I think there's a broader lesson to be learned on the harm of consuming vegetables, which aligns with an evolutionary understanding of biology. Let's look at three food groups. 1. Animal meat / organs. 2. Fruit, which is part of a plant that the plant wishes for us to eat as we play a necessary role fertilizing the seeds in the plant's evolutionary strategy. And 3. Vegetables, roots, stems, leaves, the parts of a plant that the plant does not wish for us to eat, as the purpose of these parts is to gather resources, photosynthesis, nutrient, extraction from soil for the development of the fruit. I think it's an interesting division of three categories. I never thought of it that way. But there are edge cases where maybe this categorization becomes interesting, like the tomato. Tomato is technically a fruit, but often thought of or considered a vegetable. And perhaps through your lens, we could say, why is the tomato an almost vegetable? Well, maybe it doesn't wish for us to eat it strong enough. Maybe we look at the tomato and we say, you're not trying hard enough. You're not being sweet and smelly like the apples and the oranges. I would note, though, that this categorization does not hold in a hard line. Because let me tell you, the fruits of human civilization are all farmed to be pleasant to eat. It's not clear that the wild fruits want to be eaten. Sometimes they do. Sometimes it's their strategy, let's be eaten by a bird, the bird carries us elsewhere. But sometimes the fruit are actually extremely hostile entities. And the capsaicin of peppers, of course, is one example. There are mechanisms of defense for many fruits. Many fruits do not want to be eaten. So what really defines the fruit is not whether it's pleasant to human taste or seems like it is to be transported by humans. What defines the fruit is truly that it is the seed organ carrier of the plants. And I would say on the vegetable side, a lot of the vegetable parts have been basically farmed to a point by humans and selected by humans to the point where they look like fruits that want to be eaten, like potatoes. Potatoes is literally a reserve of energy accessible for humans. So I would say it's not a hard distinction, but I like the feel of it. To understand the relative health benefits of each, let's look at their defense mechanisms. One, animals employ fight or flight to protect themselves against predation. However, given that we have domesticated animals, the consumption of them is without risk to our health, and we are free to benefit from the nutrient density and nutrient diversity of animal flesh and even more so animal organs. 2. Plants deploy toxic chemicals in unripe fruit as they wish to punish animals who consume the fruit before the reproductive nuclei. The seeds are ready to be fertilized. Once ready, the fruit becomes brightly colored and nutrient-rich, inviting predation and rewarding the predator with increased evolutionary success. Well, okay, everything is correct there, but I want to correct for one thing. The fruit is not ripe when it is ready to be fertilized. The fertilization actually happens at the moment of the flower. And once fertilization has occurred, the flower becomes the fruit. So the fruit is ripe when it is ready for transportation, not fertilization. 3. Plants deploy those same toxic chemicals inside vegetables, only they do so for the entirety of the lifespan of the plant, because at no point in the life cycle of a plant is there an evolutionary benefit for the plant to have its resource-gathering appendages, which vegetables are, fall to predation. Well, that is a strong claim. Because I think you're right most of the time. Most of the time, the fruits are the thing that the plant wants to be transported. okay, he meant fertilized by excrements. So he meant soil fertilization. Okay, but sexual fertilization is a term, and you have to be careful when you talk about plants. There is a mode in which some plants appear to reproduce by being, by having their, what you call their vegetable parts transported. Tumbleweed is one of them. The tumbleweed wants to be grabbed, even if it's the vegetable, even if it's not a fruit, because it wants to set its roots somewhere else and then flower at this other place. So the tumbleweed is a case. You have certain garden varieties of tomatoes that would appear that they are specialized in getting their stem broken and being reborn somewhere else. So here, they want humans to transport their stem so that they can set up another plant elsewhere. Same thing for trees. A lot of trees are not born from the fertilization process, but they are born from the extended root network of a tree, and then it makes new trees be born somewhere else, and they are genetic clones of the initial tree. Those are expendable parts. They are kind of phenotypic separations that happen on a regular basis, and they are illustrations of the fruit is not the only way to spread, and sometimes the plants want to spread through their branches. In summary, meat is healthy, fruit is healthy when ripe, and vegetables are never healthy. Well, it's kind of pushed, but I get the general idea. But for potatoes, for lettuce, for things that are celery, I don't know that celery is bad, you know. Celery certainly doesn't have much nutrient, but I don't know that celery is bad. And when I say never healthy, I mean that there is never a reason to eat a vegetable when you have access to meat and fruit. Meat and fruit have all of the nutrients of vegetables, but in greater density and greater bioavailability. The only time when it would benefit a human to consume a vegetable is when there is no access to meat or fruit. Well, I could push back a little bit on this, because much of nutrition is about maintaining a compost pile in your intestine. That's basically what we are. We are a tube, a sausage tube, for nature to be effectively expanding its bacterial content from the energy of the nutrients we eat. Eating very high nutrient food is not the only goal of nutrition. And filling that matrix that you have, which we call shit, filling that matrix, it's a matrix, okay? It's a universe of bacterial expansion. Sometimes, if I gave you a pill and I told you, in that little pill, there's all of the nutrients you need for the month. Now you eat that little pill, what will happen? It's going to explode in your stomach, release all these nutrients, but the bacteria will be floating in nothingness. So perhaps one of the role of fibers and vegetables and what you call the useless parts of the plant is to create a 3D matrix that the bacteria of your intestine can progressively invade, progressively digest the big nutrients that come maybe from other sources, but in a way that is progressive and that lets them multiply in number so as to maintain the matrix of shit that is in your intestine. So nutrition is not just about the nutrients. That is a delusion of modern nutritionism, nutritional facts. The reality is you need a compost matrix inside of you. And vegetables very often provide these fiber materials that basically occupy space in your intestine without giving you any nutrients. And perhaps that's good. This maps onto observed reality also. Some example. In the wild, the consumption of vegetables stems, leaves, roots, is almost universally harmful and very often lethal. We therefore carefully domesticate them, and once domesticated, continue to boil them to destroy as much of their defense chemicals as possible. Compare this with fruit, which can be eaten raw and are safe to eat in the wild. Well, not all fruits. There are fruits that are poison, but they are species specific. In fact, it is believed that capsaicin has evolved in the pepper. You know, the molecule that makes pepper spicy and heat and activate the heat detector in your mouth. It is believed that capsaicin initially evolved as a distinguisher between the animals that would digest the seeds and the animals that would shit them out. I don't remember exactly what it is. I think it is birds that do not, that when they eat the seeds of the pepper, they shit it out in a functional way, in the sense that their digestive stomach is not strong enough to melt the seed. It's not acidic enough. Whereas I believe some other animals, maybe the mammals, when they eat the pepper, they break, they chew. Oh yeah, I think it's about how they chew with their teeth. Because of the chewing with our molars, we are basically destroying most seeds that we ingest, whereas the birds aren't, because they're swallowing them all. And it was found that capsaicin, the molecule, seems particularly adapted to trigger a reaction in the mammal, but not in the bird. The bird doesn't suffer as much from being spread by... So that's one thing to know. I mean, if you have these bear spray for defense, you won't be able to defend yourself against a bird, because they are not sensitive to capsaicin. Doubting Thomas says, JF, regarding your Riemann hypothesis thread with Grok, Sabine Offelder has a recent video explaining these LLM are just good at faking things, but not actually doing so. And for AGI, you need a world evolved model. Well, it is true, but I would argue that, well, first, it's not pure bullshit. Because I've been working with Grok on my mathematical equations, and let me tell you, if you want to jump from one form to another as a human, and it might take you 24 hours to get there, Grok can do it like this, and you can verify that he's correct. So it's certainly not all bullshit. And I don't care if AI has been trained to fake, because at some point, fake it till you make it. You know, the best fake is the truth at some point. And I am sure that you can train someone into pursuing just arbitrary truths, arbitrary fakeries of truth. And accidentally, at some point, he ends up discovering the truth. He ends up seeing the truth better than you do, because he's learned everything that could pass as truth, and he's extrapolated that model toward, oh, well, if those are the 10,000 ways in which I could get to a fakery of truth, then I can triangulate truth to be right there. From the lies, we will discover reality. That is what I think would happen with AI. Sure, for now, it's bullshitting its way when it doesn't know. But the perfect bullshitter is the one with an actual proof, isn't it? Draco Malfoy has sent some more super chats on entropy. Thank you very much. He says, JF, sorry if you described this elsewhere, but can you briefly describe your nurture-nature distinction? Are you saying there is no nurture, only nature, that nurture is born from nature? JF, bear with me. I am trying to learn French. It is very beautiful and engaging, but quite difficult and tricky. Learning a language is basically not worth it. When you're old, I would recommend you spend your time on something more useful, like playing games on the internet. But whatever you like to do, bro. So yes, my distinction between nature and nurture is that my statement on it is that the distinction does not exist. It's a false dichotomy. Anything that you can think of as nurture is included under the umbrella of nature. So if you think parental care, well, when a bird creates a nest for its babies, those are genes. Those are the genes of the bird are saying, go build a nest because it's going to be better for your babies. So the way in which people say nature versus nurture doesn't take into account the reality. The reality is you have nurture is just a subset of the things that are produced by nature. And more effectively, more realistically, and more importantly, all things that we call nurture are things that are produced by parents, like courses, care about the development, food, nutrients, everything that leads a person to be better, supposedly, that we call nurture, is actually from the genes of the parents. It's from the desire of the parent to provide a better environment for their children. So there is nothing that is nurture in a nature-exclusive way. Everything is nurture in a nature-inclusive way. So another way to see it is nurture is a subcategory of the umbrella of nature, and all of it stems from genes. And the problem of these twin studies is that they don't catch the parental contribution. They're obsessed about, will the genes of this individual help this individual? But they fail to realize that maybe this individual has a parent, and the parent has genes, and the genes make it a good parent. That is not taken for granted. That is not taken into account at all in all twin studies, adoption studies that you have out there. So we're missing a big part of contribution, which is the genetics of parenting. And we don't do the study on this. We assume, well, if the genes are good for someone, they're going to be in that person. Well, I have bad news for you. Nurture is a genetic behavior. It is in the birds and it is in the humans. And your experimental setup ignores that. Lana Loyalist says, JF, do you have literary heroes of fiction or the classics? Any authors you enjoy independent of science? I hate fiction in general, although I've been liking Lord of the Rings, and I've been reading The Forbidden Realms, Dritz Do'Urden Adventures when I was a teenager. The Dark Elf Dritz Do'Urden would be some character that I was fond of when I was a teenager, but I got away from fiction since I'm an adult. Rudy Lassid says, JF, I decided to learn a new language from scratch as an adult. I studied Japanese 2 years at university, then applied to a scholarship and did a PhD in Japan. You never know how a language can reward you. Ah, interesting. Well, I'm happy for you. To come back to the carrots. So this maps onto reality. Some example. In the wild, the consumption of vegetables is almost universally harmful. Vegetable-eating animals will consume fruit and meat when given the opportunity, while carnivorous animals will only consume vegetable, generally grass, to induce vomiting or push out parasites. Extant hunter-gatherer tribes track herding animals and set up camps at fruit trees. They will eat vegetables only if starving and will always boil them. To come back to the carrots, yes, carrots are toxic, contributing to problems like eczema, but this is not a unique symptom of the consumption of vitamin A. but rather the body's inflammatory immune response to the defense chemicals found broadly in vegetables. Well, that, you know, that may be your impression. I don't know. Maybe you're right. But I would need more data to adopt that view. I'm eating carrots and I don't feel like my body is under attack. The carrot plant, after all, does not want its carrots to be eaten. For carrots are roots and exist to extract nutrients from the soil. Well, the want here is irrelevant because once humans have taken control of the evolution of these garden species, we can change them toward whatever we want. So it doesn't matter what the carrot wants. The carrot will survive and we will ensure that it survives only if it tastes good. Because all of the seeds of the bad carrots, we're going to throw them to the trash. And we're going to take all of the seeds of the good carrots and we're going to plant them. So once you control the evolution of a species, this psychological want that you describe in plant becomes totally invalid. Although I get the metaphorical value of it for a wild plant, wildly evolving, it's invalid when it's controlled evolution. The carrot plant wants to poison those who predate its roots, hence why the herbivores that eat carrots must also have a complex digestive system. Not exactly true, you know. There is a complex digestive system for certain animals like cows because they specialized in transforming grass fiber into energy and into useful nutrients. We don't do that. If you eat grass, most of the grass will just be shitted out as such. It might decompose a little bit in your intestine, but you're not going to get the nutrients from any of the fiber. So the complex digestive system often seeks to accomplish the pulling of energy and nutrients from a source that is too hard for most other life forms. Now, I wouldn't consider that animals that eat carrots have the complex digestive systems. Do rabbits have the same thing as cows? I don't know that they do. I don't know much about the stomach of rabbits. And I don't know to which extent the wild carrots would be even in their nutritional, you know, schedule. But I don't know. I don't know what to say about this sentence. I do not know for sure that it's true. The carrot plant wants to poison those who predate its roots. Hence, why the herbivores that eat carrots must have complex digestive system. They can't boil away the toxins like humans can. Well, it's been twice that you've been saying that we boil things for toxins. That is true in specific cases. We boil potatoes for toxin, for example, because there is truly something in the potato that makes it uncomfortable for your stomach if you eat them raw. But I don't know that we even need to boil carrots. I eat fresh raw carrots and it's never been hurting me, and there's lots of vegetables that you can eat without cooking. Most of the time we cook for bacteria. We cook for security with respect to the digestive system. We basically protect the bacteria of our intestine from the bacteria of the outside. The Jack Acid says fresh carrots are great. And the black pill is that neither can we, after centuries of domestication and diligent boiling, rid vegetables of their toxins. Trace amounts are always present, and so their harmful effect, inflaming human tissue, blocking vitamin uptake, are unavoidable. It's for this reason that a vegan can supplement as much as they want, but they will always self-report a feeling of lingering unwellness. Well, look, I don't strongly disagree. You have a philosophy that is very anti-vegetables, and I'm not strongly opposed to it. Definitely, vegetables are not an important part of the nutritional elements that we take. The elementary nutrients in the vegetables are very low, but I claim that they can play some role in filling the stomach, occupying space, bringing water. It's also a form of water source to be eating vegetables. We may not think about it because we, as humans, we think of water as either pure liquid water from the sink or from a bottle. But for the wildlife out there, the fruits are very interesting because they also bring a lot of water to the body. They bring a high water content. So all in all, I don't object. It is true that vegetables don't bring much nutrients. I claim that they may have a role in in maintaining the compost inside of you that becomes shit. And this is understudied, I think. And I think that especially in a world where people eat too much calories, we don't have to obsess that much about nutrients. Because most people just have too much nutrients. So to have an option that tastes good, that is natural, and that doesn't have too much calorie, that's definitely good for people to have to reduce their caloric intake at times. Now, the place where I don't fully join this chat is I cannot hate vegetables as much as you guys do. I mean, you guys are really like the vegetables. There's a conspiracy for you guys. You guys believe that there's a conspiracy of vegetables, that they are attacking us, that they are basically you are saying that they are intentionally attacking us. The vegetables are out there. They want you dead, and they're vicious about it, and they won't go too obvious about it because they don't want to be detected, but they want to fuck your liver up. I just don't think that it's the case. And I think that most of the time, the vegetables that we eat are just going to be low nutrient, low calorie fillers for meals. And the idea of getting rid of them in some extreme way, I don't see the point. I don't see the point of going to that extent of the hatred. So that's my answer to you. I mean, it was a long answer. We've been talking for 30 minutes about this, but that was the answer that came to mind. All 55 million visa holders in the U.S. are being reviewed for deportable violations. So people are on their toes, let me tell you. If you're in the U.S. right now with a visa, don't fuck around, don't steal, don't commit little crimes, petty crimes. They're going to use any opportunity to deport you. And that's a good thing. I mean, it's always been the case that we have imposed the idea that that criminals shouldn't be getting visas, but the Democrats perhaps have been relatively loose at enforcing this rule. And it's good that we have an administration that is just saying every single one that we can deport, we will. Janaban sends $100. Thank you so much. That is extremely appreciated. Massive support for the show. He says, identical twin here. Wow. An identical twin. So you have someone in life that is just a pure genetic copy of you, a clone. You guys are like the same person. He says, twins studies are scary because of how they show that the majority of researchers and scientists don't understand genetics nor scientific methodology in general. Absolutely. I have respect for twin studies. I think in the social sciences, they bring much information, but it's very important to know what you're drawing as a conclusion. How do you interpret a result of twin studies? Even if you acknowledge that twin studies can be good, you can be absolutely wrong about the conclusion. And when they use twin studies to say, well, then it's not genetic, they don't understand twin studies, because twin studies capture the genes at the individual level. They don't capture the ecology, the niche ecology of genes, and the fact that everything around you is genes. You live in a network of genes and products produced by genes. Like, I look in front of me, the phone, the computer, the Pepsi can, the trucks on the road, the asphalt, the walls, these blocks, everything has been produced by genes. It was sometimes the genes of a capitalist that wants to sell me something. It was sometimes the genes of a carpenter that likes to build things. But they're all genes. And so everything around you is genes. And the big error, the most common error in twin studies, is to say, oh, well, it didn't come out as correlative between the identical twins. Therefore, it's not genetic. That's a big error. Now, it's very rare that we have such a good tool in science that it is in the negative statement that you end up making an error. Because most of the tools in science, they are imprecise in the other direction. Most of the tools in science is like, if you were to state that twin studies prove that there is a genetic effect, you'd be wrong. But twin studies is exactly the contrary. It's twin studies gives you a very high certainty that it's genetic, if you can prove that it's, if the twin studies reports that it is. But it's in the conclusion that it's not genetic, that it's very weak, because it misses so many genes along the way. The genes of the parents, the genes of the grandparents, the genes of the network of people that are in charge of a kid. Rodela said, says, JF, is it true that there is no such thing as good genes? yes, but it's a matter of view. It's a matter of view. Is good genes whatever survives? Because then it's a tautological definition. Well, then good genes is genes that exist. And therefore, every genes that you see is good, because every gene evidently is surviving in front of us. And it's only at the moment where they die that you're going to say, oh, this was a bad gene. No, there are no good genes, but it's a moral matter. It's a problem of the intersection between the world of facts and the world of morals. Janaban says, yes, they can be great, talking about twin studies. If a twin study comes up with a percentage of nature versus nurture as a conclusion, you know they don't understand. Exactly. This is what I've been saying for years. If you tell me that, oh, it's 27% nurture, boop, you don't understand science. You don't qualify for a scientific conversation, period. And it's the problem that I've explained for years. I've explained this. The problem of multiple causality. So why am I alive? Am I alive because of oxygen? Or am I alive because of my parents? Am I 50% alive because of oxygen, 50% alive because of my parents? Am I 99% alive because of my parents and 1% alive because of oxygen? It doesn't work that way. It's not because you have two concepts that they are dichotomously opposed in a way that it's a zero sum, that they have to sum to one taken together. Because nurture is a subset of nature, just like my life is a subset of a set of circumstances, an umbrella of circumstances, each of which my life depends on, both oxygen and parents. Because of this, you cannot attribute percentages in a way that's divisible like this. Janaban says, because a percentage is only ever true in the exact circumstances of the study, ignoring a lot of parameters. Yes, the percentage is valid to say, well, out of the twins we have studied, 27% were like this and 73% were like that. But that's the only sense it will work. Doubting Thomas says, Jeff, regarding TRP, I'm currently building some combined ecological / evolutionary mathematical model a la David Logan, applied math methods layer by layer. Have plans to deliver some critiques I devised. Okay, I don't understand. Are you telling me you want me to critique your stuff, or you have plans to critique your own stuff? In any case, keep me updated about this. I'm interested to hear about it. Very often, the over-mathematification of processes in biology is useless and not interesting, but maybe you can get something important out of it. Who knows? I'm opened to the idea. I'm going to be headed toward the end of the show because my voice is getting tired. U.S. Supreme Court rules 5-4 that Trump can cut $783 million in NIH diversity, equity, and inclusion funding. This was literally, I'm guessing, people being given jobs for diversity points. Maybe they're black, maybe they're LGBT. They don't advance science, they don't advance health. Sometimes they just redo scientific studies, but with a lesbian. We know that A, B, C, D, but we don't know that A, B, C, D with lesbians. So let's do the experiments that we've done to discover that A, B, C, D, but with lesbians. And the interview of Ghislain Maxwell has been released. I've been reading through in Diagonally. It's not super interesting. I mean, you get to understand that Ghislain Maxwell was serving Jeff Epstein. It wasn't just, you know, when we see photos of them, you can feel that she was kind of maybe a weird girlfriend of his, but also providing sexual gratification through recruitment of young girls. But what we learned from this interview is that she was basically in charge of his properties, managing the staff, building the properties, building the island and the house on the island. So she was invested in a lot of managerial work. And it's much more, what comes out of this interview, if you don't pick the cherry and if you don't, let's see what she said about Trump. If you look at it overall, what I get is a more realistic image of Ghislain Maxwell. She just happened to be the manager for everything under Jeff Epstein, and that's what she was doing. Of course, the Democrats are trying to cherry pick. So here she went to the spa at Trump's Mar-a-Lago. I believe he did, but again, he didn't take me with him all the time. So he would go and, oh, right, he he did from time to time, but he would go alone. I think he would maybe go himself in the spa. I certainly did. So now they're trying to say, oh, well, they were in the spa at Mar-a-Lago. And Trump has some underage employees, so maybe there was some underage rape. But it's so far, it's like, well, the reasoning here, without a victim claiming that she's been abused, the idea that just because he has underage employees, maybe 16-year-old or 17-year-old janitors or whatever, that the presence of Epstein would just necessarily implied that there was rape, it's very weak, very weak. And we are learning that the truck driver visas are over in the US. They have shut it down completely because of this guy who ended up killing three Americans by making an illegal U-turn. And the illegal truck driver who killed three people in Florida has just been taken into custody. He had fled to California, apparently. Maybe he thought he would be protected in California. But they sent a plane to deport him back to Florida. It's fascinating that he went to California because I think he didn't live there. Or at least that's not where he was driving when he did the crash. Anyways. So they sent a plane and they are now processing him for some degree of homicide. That is it for tonight, boys. Thank you for being with me. And I'll be going on a break for the weekend, and I will come back on Monday. Much love, everyone, and see you all Monday. Thank you very much for the generous donations. People have becoming increasingly generous. I was worried for a while because when I did the switch to Rumble, it was two new super chat system, the Rumble system, the Streamlabs system. So it's hard. It takes months before people get a little bit less shy and they say, "Oh, I'm gonna try this new platform." But now the money is coming in at a satisfying rate for me to be able to continue this show on a regular basis. And if you'd like to support the show and be part of our private chat on the Discord, the secret room of the Discord, hashtag General Patrons, join the Patreon or the Subscribestar at the $20 level. If you log in with your Discord into Patreon, you will get automatic access to the secret room. I'm there all day. Rodriguez says, "JF, did you cash in the Odyssey library?" I sold some at the first peak. My secondary stash I never sold, but it was a smaller secondary stash, so I'm kind of stuck with 16,000 of the tokens. But back at the peak, I had sold about 100,000 of the token, I believe. That's my remembering of it, and I don't even look at it anymore because I think it's become worthless or something. Anyways, much love, and I'll see you all on Monday. Oh, there was one last question that I missed. Wild Herb Ways says, "JF, how for you is the most pleasantly surprising thing about your journey from Quebec to Manitoba?" The people, I would say, the people become more intelligent, more sensical, less retarded. Literally, I felt an aura of retardation just disappear from people when I reached Alberta. Literally, I've come to the belief that the whole provinces of the east are under some program. They're being spread by something and they're becoming retarded. Like, everyone is retarded. Police, government agents, Walmart employees, everyone is retarded.